Well, thank you so much for the opportunity. And just let me say, as we start, I have been an elementary principal, and I am quite empathetic to the role you have and how it works. Everywhere I go right now in the United States, I get these comments about kids out of control, parents out of control, and it's particularly problematic at elementary. I'm sure you know, but more 4- and 5-year-olds were put in alternative placement last year than any other grade levels. And what's happening is people are dealing with two things in particular are happening. One, they're trying to treat a discipline issue, a behavioral issue as a discipline issue, and it's actually an emotional one. And number two, the strategies that you need and the language that you need to understand what's happening basically has not been given to educators. So what I did is I went back into the clinical research, and it's all there. But what I did was extrapolate why things are happening the way they are from a brain-based perspective, and then quick, not expensive strategies you can use to calm kids down, regulate brains, and move them on. So at the end of this seminar, I'm going to give you a email address that you can email a physical. If you email that email and give your physical address, we will send you a free book. The book is called Emotional Poverty. It looks like this, and you will get a free book. Also, just as we start, a question will come up about slides. And if you want the PowerPoint slides, we ask that you go through a certification workshop so that you understand the material well enough to present it. On a framework understanding poverty, I gave out slides initially, and some of it really boomeranged back on me. So I've learned to ask for a little bit of training before we give out slides. But having said that, we have 50 minutes and then time for questions. So let me kind of give you an overview of what's in the book. First of all, we look at why children explode from a brain-based angle, and it's basically they've got an unregulated, unintegrated brain, and then how do you calm them down, okay? Then we look at what motivates behavior. One of the things we know is it's pretty hard to change behavior, but you can change the motivation for the behavior. The third thing we're going to look at is why discipline works with some kids and not others' kids. Why do strategies work with some and not others? And a lot of it has to do with bonding and attachment. Then we're going to look at the campus level. What are things that happen that make situations less than and separate from? Why do we have so many issues with males? And I have to be very careful with this one because politically it's kind of a hot topic. But 76% of educators are female, but 50% of the student population is male, okay? Just yesterday, I got a report about the number of minority males that are being kicked out of kindergarten, okay? And part of the issue is this, is that male and female brains actually don't process emotion the same way. And there's some quick and simple tools when you know those, get much better outcomes. And the reason I say the numbers don't work is this. The majority of our discipline referrals are male. The majority of our special ed kids are male. The majority of our dropouts are male. The bottom line is the numbers aren't working very well, and part of it is a brain-based issue, part of it. And then the last one we're going to look at that administrators like the best, interestingly enough, is what the emotional realities adults bring into the classroom. And it's called emotional noise in the classroom. Let me ask you a question in the chat box. How many of you have noticed there's more noise before holidays and after holidays? More emotional noise. There's just more restlessness, angst. How many of you have noticed that? If you don't mind typing in the chat box. And how many of you have noticed that some classrooms have more noise than other classrooms? The bottom line is that what we know about that is that there are stages that adults go through in the research, and each one of those stages has to do with where they are in terms of adult development. And so we look at when you know that, what that means, and how you begin to work with that from an administrative standpoint. In this workshop, and I'm going to give you a highlights on several of these, we only have about 45, 50 minutes, and the book has a study guide in the back that you can do a book study with your staff if you wish. But the reality is one principal friend of mine who uses this a lot said to me, Ruby, we get a lot of staff development about things that are predictable, how to do curriculum, how to do instruction. He said, but we get almost no staff development on how to deal with the unpredictabilities that show up every day. And so there are a lot of strategies in here for that. So having said that now, I want to highlight, and I noticed that many of you responded in the chat box that absolutely you have seen that noise level. And I think if you've been in the building very long, you know what I mean. So as we start this, I would like you to do this. Type in the chat box the initials, not the name, the initials of either a student or a staff member for that matter, okay, who if they were not in your life would be better, okay? In other words, it's kind of like on the way to school in the morning, you pray, you go, dear God, maybe so-and-so could be sick today, okay? Just type in the initials of that person, okay? Not their name. We just need initials. MM, LJ, AS, NB, CG, WR. Okay, you've got them, all right, and you know who they are. And I'm going to ask you as we go through some of this information to think back about that person and what that means. Having said all that now, I would like to give you just some basics about emotions that are in the research, okay? Number one. All emotional wellness is based in two things, safety and belonging. So one of the issues for your students, your parents, you, me, anybody, is that when we get upset, we believe that either our safety or our belonging has been jeopardized. Okay? Number two, emotions are pretty simple. You're either moving towards something or you're moving away from it or attacking it to get it away from you. So it's a very simple kind of complex. One of the things is that you get about 12 trillion stimuli coming at you all the time, and you have to have a very fast way to sort. And so you sort. Am I safe? Do I belong? Do I like it? Do I not? Okay. Your amygdala is highly structured by the time you're 3. Now, it gets restructured in adolescence, but it's quite structured by the time you're 3. Not totally, but quite heavily structured. It's difficult to change behavior. It's fairly easy to change the motivation for the behavior, and there's a technique in the book called validation that allows you to do that. The difference between beneficial and non-beneficial behavior, good, bad, healthy, unhealthy, psychologists don't like to reference behavior as good or bad. So beneficial or not is compassion. And I'm doing a lot of research right now on a second book that will be out next year, in Emotional Poverty 2. And one of the most interesting things that your brain does in adolescence when it restructures, it does something called perspective taking, which means that you have the ability to see someone else's perspective. And that builds compassion. We're always going to keep consequences, but we can change the approach. And then our frequent flyers, we often reference them as bad or sick, but they're actually injured. And so one of the things I'm going to ask you is to think about that concept as we go through this. They're injured. And what does that mean? Let me ask you in the chat box, how many of you have dealt with an injured animal? Yes. One of the things is that several of you said yes. When you deal with an injured animal, one of the things you understand, you have to have some boundaries, but you don't want to re-injure them. So I want to give you some ways to think about your children who are injured, okay? And you can't change a behavior that's not named. And so one of the purposes of this material is just to give to educators naming, name what's happening and what they are doing. And emotions are very fast. 200 to 5,000 times faster than thought. So kids react. Adults react often before you have a chance to know about it. So what I'm going to do with you now is do some very basics, and then we will open it up for questions. But what is it? What's the definition? Well, you're not going to find emotional poverty in DSM-5. By the way, in the chat box, do you know, yes or no, what DSM-5 is, what that is? Yes. For those of you who do not know, DSM-5 is the Bible of mental health, okay? It lists everything that can be wrong with you in there, and if it's not in there, you can't have it, okay? It's what psychologists, psychiatrists, clinicians, counselors use to determine coding for insurance, okay? But the bottom line, you won't find it. But it's actually four things. It's when the brain is unregulated and unintegrated. Number two is when your attachment and bonding is underdeveloped and it's not secure. So you don't feel safe and you don't feel like you belong. Your inner self is underdeveloped and your inner hurts dominate. And your external environment tells you that you're less than and separate from. One of the reasons that racism, sexism, is so damaging is that it actually sends a subtle message that you are less than and separate from. And one of the things that we're going to do now is look at it. Now, the way I start with audiences is this. We start with an unregulated, unintegrated brain, and what is it? And I'm going to give you a simplified version of this that you can follow along. And Taryn, the slides will not be available after the webinar, but you can take certified training and get the slides. If you go to our website, you will find that. I have an address for the website at the end, okay? But let me show you, and if you don't mind doing this with me right now, on a piece of paper, if you have a piece of paper, I'm going to ask that you lay your palm down on that paper and trace around it with your hand up, if you don't mind. Because what I'd like to do is give you terminology and language that you can use with students to explain to them what's happening in their brain. Okay? It's an oversimplification, but when you have this for students, you can start teaching them about how to recognize and control their own reactions. Okay? So, actually, if we were being honest about this, I know this is kind of awkward, okay, but if you don't mind, when you draw this out your palm on your hand, okay, lay it down so the back of your hand's on the paper and you're tracing around it. Your brain is actually, if you put your two hands together like this, this is actually the size of your brain, and your brain is about 3 pounds, and it's the consistency of soft butter, okay? And one of the things that happens is, it has two hemispheres, right and left, okay, and it's two thumbs, okay, but we're only going to use one side of the hand, okay, and so if you don't mind right now, on this part of your hand right here, the palm, if you don't mind labeling it the brainstem, okay, and the brainstem is connected to your wrist, which is your spinal cord, represents your spinal cord. And one of the most interesting things is that what communicates between your brainstem and your spinal cord is something called a vagus nerve, okay? V-A-G-U-S nerve. It's the longest nerve in the body. And what your brainstem done basically is it controls your involuntary and your motivational systems. It is where you decide whether you're going to run, to fight, okay, or to freeze. And one of the books that I will tell you about is a book by a guy named Joe Navarro. He's an FBI guy. Let me ask you in this, the first thing your brain has to decide, when you're an infant, you've got all these things coming at you simultaneously. And so what you're deciding is, what's my response going to be? Am I going to freeze, fight, or flee, run? Joe Navarro, he's from FBI, what do you think in the chat box does he say is the most honest part of the body? In other words, if you want to know if somebody's telling you the truth, what do you watch? Okay, in the chat box, what would you say? All right, most of you said the eyes or the face. You would be, according to him, you're incorrect. The most important thing to watch is the feet. And let me explain why. Your feet, when you have a response and it hits your brainstem and you have to involuntary, it's your breathing, your eating, your sex, all your motivational system. The first thing that happens when you have an emotional hit is your brain has to decide, am I going to run, am I going to freeze, or am I going to fight? And the first indicator of that is your feet. And he said one of the things you want to watch is the feet. For example, He said that what the limbic system does is it responds almost immediately and your feet jerk. It's the indicator. And he said then what your body will do almost simultaneously, it will do a soothing mechanism. And one of the most common soothing mechanisms is you rub right here. Okay? Women will pull on their waitresses, on their necklaces. Men will pull on their ties or play with their collars. He was telling a story about they were in this woman's home and FBI was, and they were investigating. They were hunting for her son and they were pretty sure that the son was hiding in the home. And so they asked the mother, does your son ever stay here? Her foot jerked and she said no. And then she started doing this. About 10 minutes later, they asked her, what bedroom would your son stay in if he stayed here? Her foot jerked and she said he never stays here. And she did this. Couple minutes later, they said, so which bed does he sleep in when he's here? And her foot jerked and she said, he never stays here. Okay. Well, they did a search of the house and he was there. Okay. But one of the things is the feet. So he said, law enforcement, educators, they don't watch the feet. It's the first indicator. And so for those of you that have young children who kick and hit, the feet are what you want to watch. And you know, the immediate response of the brainstem was to run, to fight. To flee. Then the thumb, if you want to label this next, is the amygdala. And the amygdala is the emotional center of your brain. Okay. It is structured. It's the part that tends to be highly structured by the time you're three. And it's structured on the basis of am I safe and do I belong? And do I like it or don't I? So for example, I smell the milk, the bottle, I like it. I like the person who holds me. I'm going to move toward that. I don't like it. I'm going to move away from it or attack it. Okay. And based on those two things, is it safe and do I belong? People decide what has value to them. Emotion. What is the motion that I'm going to move to emotionally? Okay. And one of the most interesting things about this, the thumb, it is structured before people have language. So it is structured without language and people act on information they don't even know they have because it got structured so young. Let me ask you in this chat box, how many of you have done something and then you thought to yourself, oh no, that's my mother again, that's my father. How many in the chat box, for how many of you has that happened? Yes, several of you are saying yes. Well, you know what happened? You responded, you don't know why, but that was embedded in you. Unfortunately, I open my mouth and my mother's voice comes out. Exactly. And the bottom line, it got embedded there before you ever had language. Okay. And that's where trauma's lodged, right there in that thumb. The next part of the brain is the back of the hand. If you want to label that, that's the cortex and that's where you go for thoughts. So when somebody goes for thinking, they go to their cortex. And it's where thoughts begin. And then these two middle fingers are your prefrontal cortex. Your prefrontal cortex is a regulator of your brain, okay? It is what keeps your behavior in check. Like in the chat box, again, if you don't mind, how many of you have been on the freeway and you thought seriously about helping somebody off the road that you didn't like how they were driving, okay? In the chat box, what did you say to yourself to keep from doing that? Why didn't you do that? Not worth it. I won't be that helpful. I know I'd be at fault and wouldn't want to be in trouble. That person isn't worth it. People get shot over things like this. Yep. Your prefrontal cortex got in. I don't want to go to jail. Your prefrontal cortex got in and stopped the behavior. And here's what happens. When your brain is not integrated, your amygdala is not talking to your brainstem, and it's not talking to your cortex. It's not integrated. Okay? And it's not regulated. Your prefrontal cortex is not regulating the response. And then what you have is this. And in your face. Now what happens? This is Daniel Siegel's, model, and I think it's a great one, and it's simple enough you can explain it to kids. See, the problem is this. When they explode, we have historically been taught that that is a form of disrespect. And so what happens a lot of times is the educator goes back like this. Well, when you have a student who did this and an educator who does this, then you've basically got two unregulated brains in the room, and it doesn't work. So one of the first things that has to happen is people have to say to themselves, okay, I'm looking at an unregulated, unintegrated brain, and what am I going to do about that? And one of the things we do is we teach this to kids because it gives, when they calm down, we can say to them, did your brain just do this? And they'll go, mm-hmm. What can we do so it stays like this? But one of the things you have to do is you have to work on regulation of the brain. And if you want to right now with your cell phone, you can take a picture of this slide because this slide is right here and you can download it for free from our webpage, okay? And basically what it is it are these zero, every child, kindergarten and first grade has a teddy bear. And what happens is that these are lessons you Xerox off, and what you're doing is they're lessons about how to behave at school, okay? And so they teach it to their teddy bear, okay? And every day their teddy bear behaves, i.e. them, they get a sticker. And if their teddy bear's having trouble, i.e. they are having trouble at school, we just say to them, hey, you know, why don't you go back and teach Teddy this lesson? Because you know what? He's having a little bit of trouble with it, or she is having a little bit of trouble with it. And what we're doing is you're building a voice in the brain. Let me give you an example. When I was an elementary principal, we had this third grade boy, and he had ADHD in the worst sort of way, okay? And his mom didn't want him to have meds. So one of the things we had to do was get him a regulated voice as much as possible. And at the simplest level, regulation of the brain is a voice inside your brain that talks to you. So what we said to him was this, do you have this voice inside your head that tells you to do things you shouldn't be doing? And he goes, mm-hmm. We said, what's his name? He said, Jack. And we said, does Jack sit right here on your shoulder and talk to you and tell you things to do? Yeah, mm-hmm. What kinds of things does Jack tell you to do? Well, he tells me to run around the room and get up, run around the room. What should you say to Robert what should you say to Jack when he tells you that? And he said, I can't run around right now. I have to wait to recess. I said, okay. What else does Jack tell you to do? Well, he tells me to hit Robert in the back of the head. What do you need to tell Jack when he says that? Well, I can't hit Robert right now. I gotta wait to recess to hit Robert in the back of the head. No, no, no. We need to work on this one. Okay. Well, during the class then, when he was out of control, the teacher would look at him and she'd go. And the little boy would go. Okay. And he would be good for another 15 minutes. But the bottom line is you're building in the regulation of regulatory behavior. Okay. That's one tool. The book has several others. Well, one of the things you understand when you begin to understand how this regulated unintegrated brain operates, then the question becomes is how do you calm them down? What do you have to do to calm kids down? And the book has a whole list of calming strategies. I want to give you two in particular before we go on. But one is looking up. Do something for me right now. All right, bow your head and recall how you felt when you graduated from high school. Okay. Now look at the ceiling. Okay. In the chat box, what happened to that thought? If you don't mind, in the chat box, what happened to your thoughts? Yeah, they went away. It disappeared. Yep, it goes away. And here's why. Let me ask you this next question for the chat box. How many of you have watched a student? They've walked through the halls, their heads down, covered with a hoodie, and their shoulders are slumped. How many of you have seen that? Daily. Yes, yes, yep, all the time. What do you know? What you know right away about that student is that they're processing emotions and they're negative emotions. Okay, look. This comes from neurolinguistic programming. If you look at my face right now, this is 12 o'clock, 6 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 9 o'clock. When your eyes are anywhere across the top of your head, anywhere across here from 10 to 2, your eyes are up. What your brain is doing neurologically is you are accessing what is being stored visually. When your eyes are moving between your ears, you're accessing sounds. When your eyes are down, you're accessing feelings. The fastest way to calm down a kid who won't quit crying or a kid who's angry or a kid who's upset is to make them look at the ceiling. Not too long ago, I was in I ran into a counselor who'd been in one of my workshops. She said, Ruby, that thing about looking up, she said, we had this little boy, she said, all last year in first grade, we spent all this time working on him on regulation and his calming him down. And she said, now this year, we just put him in a beanbag chair in the back of the room when we see he's getting agitated and we have puppies and dogs and cats on the ceiling and we change him out and we say to him, hey, go look up there and see what you can see. What's different today? And I mean, she said, Ruby, in 2 minutes, he's calmed down. It's just your brain can't access it. Okay. And it is a very fast way to calm children down. Making them look up. Another one, there's several on here we don't have time for today, but one I want to talk about with males is water. I want to explain something about male processing. Now, I need to be careful about this and just say this, okay? In the brain scanners, they can tell, a computer can accurately decipher 75% of the time by a brain scan whether you're dealing with a male or a female brain. Think of brains as a Venn diagram. You got the male side, you got the female side, and then you got this part in the middle they both share. Okay? But one of the issues, and there's a pushback right now, departments of higher ed, feminist studies, to not talk about the difference. People want to get in this argument, is it nature or it's nurture? Actually, it's both, okay? But the bottom line is they are sexual. The brain is sex chromosomed in some aspects. So the bottom line is when you look at behavior, okay, you want to look at the child, but know this, that male brains have more blood flow within hemispheres. Female brains have more blood flow across hemispheres. So one of the reasons it's much easier for female brains to deal with emotions and language is they got more blood flow across the hemispheres. In other words, the right hemisphere is more about emotion, the left hemisphere is more about language. If you got more blood flow, it's easier to talk about what's bothering you. Well, one of the reasons and why water is so valuable is this. Water metabolizes cortisol. And when you get upset, your amygdala produces cortisol. So if you want it metabolized faster, you have them drink 10 to 12 ounces of water. And it's particularly important for males. And let me explain why. When a female brain has an emotional hit, that information is throughout the brain within 2 minutes in MRI brain scans. And the first thing a female brain will do when it has an emotional hit is cry and talk, tend and befriend. When a male brain has an emotional hit, it's in the base of the skull. By emotional hit, I mean anything that jeopardizes safety or belonging. It's in the base of the skull in the right hemisphere, down here. In the chat box, how much time on the average would you say, how many hours on the average does it take before that information gets throughout the whole male brain? In the chat box, how many hours would you say? 3, 1, 6, 2, 5, 0. In the brain research, it's 3 to 5 hours. And the first thing that a male brain wants to do is left alone and be silent. One of the things we do in the school business is that we'll have two males get in a fight, for example. They get called in front of a female administrator or female teacher. The first thing we say to them is, tell me what happened. You know what? They barely know they've been in a fight yet, okay? And then when they sit there and don't talk, We punish them again. We say you're recalcitrant, you're defiant, you're uncooperative. When females sit there and cry and talk, we don't punish them a second time for that. But we do tend to punish males a second time for not talking and not cooperating. So one of the tools I want to give you is one of the fastest ways to calm them down is to drink water. Make them drink 10 to 12 ounces of water before you talk to them and wash their shoulders. I know one female principal does this. She, when they come in there, she gives them a bottle of water and she says, look, I don't have time to talk to you right now. I got to finish this computer report. You drink your water when I get this report done, then we'll talk. And she watches them out of the corner of the eye to see one, when they're done drinking water, and two, when their shoulders relax. Okay. The second and third things you need to know about male processing is that for whatever reason, they're going to process faster if you're shoulder to shoulder instead of eye to eye. So I've had people say to me, well, I want them to look at me. And I said, well, okay, but if you want better info, if you want them to talk to you, then do shoulder to shoulder. I'm not sure why that works, but it does. And number three, they'll talk more if they can do something with their hands while they talk, play with something or whatever, or if there's some sort of movement, like they walk with you. And I think it's because male brains have more gray matter than female brains do. And gray matter is related to movement. Well, once you get them calmed down and there's several calming strategies, then you can begin the conversation. Now, to move on, we then talk about what motivates behavior that you don't want. And it has to do with the weak inner self. And what we know is that in the workshop, we go through the developmental stages that Erickson and others have identified about how you build your emotional self. And you build it from birth, okay? And one of the things is that building of birth, there's certain things you have to do. Like birth to 1 year old, you have to figure out where you are on the trust-distrust continuum, okay? Do you trust the adults? Do you trust the environment? Or you just learn to distrust it? And one of the things we know is if they learn to distrust things in that first year of life, then authority tends to be an issue for them in their life, okay? Because you learn to distrust it, okay? Then 2 and 3 is autonomy versus shame. Are you made too much fun of? Are you allowed to be who you are? One of the things, and these stages go on and we talk about them, what you get from those emotionally and where you are. And the reason this becomes important in the school business is this. Where a person is chronologically is not where they are emotionally necessarily. Let me tell you this story. I was working with an elementary principal and she said, Ruby, I have this fourth grade girl. She's 11 years old and she makes her bowel movements on the floor of the bathroom. She won't go in the toilet. She said, we've done everything we know. We've talked to her, et cetera. It doesn't work. I said, well, tell me about the girl. She said, well, when she was 3 years old, she was put in foster care because of abuse. I said, okay. You're dealing with a 3-year-old. She said, no, she's 11. I said, look, chronologically, she's 11. Emotionally, she's 3. You learn to be potty trained. Autonomy is based in part on being able to do that by the time you're 3. I said, emotionally, she's 3 years old. And the research is wherever you are, wherever your abuse was started or wherever the drug addiction started, that's where you stop emotional growth until you either get treatment or you build a strong relationship with an adult. But I said, she's 3. And so I worked with a different elementary principal who went back, her staff, they went through the students they see the most frequently and figured out where they were emotionally. I mean, based on the stages of development. And based on those, if you develop more shame than autonomy, more distrust than trust, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, then what we know is your inner self is weak. And that's important for this reason. It's the motivation for good behavior. Okay? So if I develop more shame, more guilt, more the stages, different stages, then I'm going to have a weaker inner self. And the research is simply this. Or I can have a strong inner self. I have autonomy. I have trust. I have initiative. I have productivity. Okay. If I develop on the strong side, then I'm going to engage in the behavior that reinforces my inner self. It's this amygdala, the inner self right here. And what we know is this, is that if I have a weak inner self, okay, and something happens, then my immediate thing is I'm afraid that I lost safety or belonging. And then I have a choice. I'm going to be angry. And angry is fabulous. Anger is a fabulous chemical because it does two things at once. It gives you energy. It's an amphetamine and it's an analgesic. It numbs your pain. Okay. And so I'm going to be angry and then I have a choice. I can either project that onto you. I can attack you. Homicide, harming other people, or I can attack myself. Suicide, anxiety, but I'm going to project it because I don't have the inner strength. And there's a technique called validation that you can build that strength. Why do discipline strategies work with some kids and not others? It's bonding and attachment. And basically in that research, they identified four styles of bonding and attachment. Now, these are not disorders. They're styles. There's also disorders. These are styles. And when we go through the styles on page 42 in the book, one of the things we look at is what happens. The research behind this was a research study called Infant Strange, and it was done in two researchers, Ainsworth and Bowlby. Bowlby said this, when somebody is an infant, when they're born, they can't tell a stranger from who they love. By the time they're 1 year old, they know who they love and who they don't. They recognize them. They know when they come, they bring them joy. They know when they leave, they cry. And based on that is the emotional foundation of your life. Well, Bowlby and Ainsworth did this research study called Infant Strange. And what they did is they took 1 year olds and they put them in a room with a two-way mirror, put toys in there. They'd have the caregiver drop them off, which is usually the mother, okay? And the caregiver would drop them off, okay? And they watched then how the one-year-old reacted to the parent leaving. Did they play with the toys? Then they would have strangers walk in and out of the room to see, did they know they were different? How did they react to them? Then they'd have the caregiver come back and see how they were greeted and treated. And based upon that, they identified four styles of bonding and attachment. Well, one of the styles, secure and attached, these all come with different styles of disciplining. But one that drives teachers nuts and educators is the insecure, anxious, and avoidant. They're just not attached to relationships. They're loners and they don't care. And we've all dealt with a loner and they're difficult to motivate and they're virtually impossible to discipline. Because they're not attached. Siegel says the circuitry and the right, the emotional circuitry didn't get attached. But sometimes they're autistic, okay, by genetics. So the bottom line is they're not attached. These are loners. And for those of you who, anybody on here who's secondary, I don't think there is, but that's one group shooters come from, okay? Now, just because you're in the group doesn't mean you'll shoot, but it's a group. The next one is anxious. They're not attached. They don't know whether they're safe and they don't know if they belong. Okay. Secure and attached know they're safe and they know they belong. Okay. Anxious kids are the ones that are at your desk all the time. Did I do this right? Did I do this right? Is this right? I don't know if I can do it. Okay. They're not sure. Okay. And then the last group is called safe and dangerous. Stosny, who was a researcher who researches why men beat women, coined as safe and dangerous. In the Ainsworth and Bowlby research, it's called disorganized and dismissive. But the bottom line is this, sometimes they're safe and sometimes they're dangerous. And one of the things is, it's the other group shooters come from, but a lot of times I need to give you this stat. 10% of all adults fit in this category. But 80% of children who come out of drug addicted households fit in this category. And it's a different way to discipline. how you deal with them is different. And I don't have time to talk about that, but it's one of the things that educators need to know as they begin to find appropriate strategies, okay? Now, the male thing, I gave you one strategy about that. The last thing I'd like to touch on is this emotional noise business, okay, and stages of adult development, and then open it up for questions. But in the chat box, what is the most dangerous age to be an adult? More adults twist off in that age than any other age. If you don't mind in the chat box, what would you say it is? 18 to 21, 25, 21, 22, 18 to 28, 16 to 24, 18, 18 to 21. You would all be wrong, okay? It is in the research 35 to 45. In the chat box, if you don't mind in the chat box, why would that be the most dangerous age to be an adult? More adults twist off in that age than any other age. Yes. Yes. Why? Why do you think that is? What do I mean by twist off? Okay. Let me give you an example of twisting off. Unhappy with choices made previously, stress buildup, raising kids, aging parents. Here's an example of twisting off. It's the biggest adjustment period, fail or failure aging. Here's what part of the issue that people don't know about is this. But let me give you an example of twisting off. I know this superintendent in South Texas. Now, this happened several years ago, okay? And the details are sketchy, okay? But what did happen is this. This superintendent took himself and several of his assistant superintendents to Las Vegas for the American Association of School Administrators, okay? Now, what did happen was this. The superintendent and one of his assistant superintendents ended up at the Elvis Chapel of Love and got married. There was only one problem. They were both already married. Okay? That's called twisting off, okay? And the bottom line is what happens in that time frame, you've got huge things happening, and they all surface emotionally. And the noise in the classroom is this. So when we go talk with teachers about this whole concept, we talk about energy levels, and we talk about stages where the adults are in terms of their emotional triggers, in terms of their energy, and in terms of what's happening to them. Because all your life, you change in these four areas of perception. Self in relationship to others, the proportion of danger, safety you think you have in your life, your perception of time, and how alive or stagnant you are. Let me ask you this question. How many of you in the chat box, how many of you have dealt with bitter, angry adults? Well, the research is this, that they have stagnated. They have not been able to deal with the developmental tasks, and they've actually stagnated. Here's what happens. Every human being is wounded. Everybody is, okay? But if you allow your wounds to define you, as opposed to become a part of you, then you stagnate. How many of you have met someone who got divorced 20 years ago, but if it happened yesterday? How many in the chat box, how many of you have dealt with someone like that? Yes, that's an example of someone who has had a wound and it has defined them and they have stagnated, okay? So one of the things is, how do you move beyond that? And so what we do when we do this is we have the staff, your faculty, break up into groups. I'll ask them, if you're in your 20s or would like to be in your 20s, would you go in this group? If you're in your 30s or would like to be in your 30s, this group, 40s, 50s, and 60s. And then we have them talk about the advantages and disadvantages of that age. And then they share with the whole staff. And then in the book, we talk about the emotional things you have to deal with that. For example, for a teacher in their 20s, a beginning teacher, okay, their primary driving force is, what should I do to be a teacher and folks, a good teacher? And one of the things we know in the research is that If you don't have a mentor in your 20s, it is a developmental handicap for the rest of your career, okay? So, and it shows up in the building. One last story here, but a friend of mine who's a principal and who uses this work in his building, he had a beginning teacher in her 20s get mad at a teacher in her 40s, okay? And she texted her, "I'm going to defriend you on Facebook," okay? Well, the teacher in her 40s went, "Woo, that makes my heart go pitter-patter," okay? The bottom line is she didn't care, okay? Because in your 40s, that's friends are not an overriding concern, and you don't think everybody's going to like you. So it's how it shows up in conflicts in the staff. And so it's been a wonderful way to talk to adults in a way adults can hear about what are you bringing in and what are your students bringing in emotionally and how do you do that dance? How do you deal with that dance in the classroom? Then we finish up with what you can do. And there's a lot we can do to mitigate and change the emotional outcomes. Okay? So it's 3:45 right now, almost 3:50, 3:48. This is the time for you to ask questions in the chat box. And I'm going to, this was a quick and dirty, but if you send an email to this person, we will, and a physical address, we'll send you a free book and you can get the rest of this information.
So can I ask you, Ruby, this is Honor. I just want to ask, get the ball rolling. With your workshop and that sort of thing, do you go out and help principals directly in schools or how does this work?
Yeah, I do workshops and I have several consultants who do workshops too, who go through this with the staff, and help give them the strategies, talk to them about that, do all these things with the staff, give them lots of strategies. The book is full of strategies because that's what educators need, okay? Mm-hmm. You got 25 kids in front of you, you don't have time to go get a book and see now what should I do with this kid. You have to have stuff right there, so yes. We do that and we have certified training so you can go, it's online so you don't have to travel anywhere. We have it in person and online. You can go on our website and sign up and do it online. And then you get the PowerPoints, all the PowerPoints.
Okay. Oh, that's wonderful. What would you recommend as a first step for, you know, somebody dealing with a lot of these issues at their school?
One of the things I'd recommend is get the book, read it, or go online and take the course. We have an online course that you can take. It's 2 days, 3 hours each day. And then we have a on-demand course you can take that you go through it at your own leisure. And then we also have the certification course. So there's a lot of ways, or read the book. There's a lot of ways to get the info.
Excellent. And Michelle writes, you said several minutes back that anger had two factors. Could you go into that a little more?
Yes. When your brain produces anger, people always produce anger when they're afraid, okay? And they're afraid because they believe they either lost safety or belonging, okay? And what happens in your brain, I didn't have time to explain this, when you think you lost safety, it changes the physiology of your body. Your vagus nerve sends down information to your brain, down your spine. It changes your breathing. It changes the chemicals you produce. And so safety and belonging, then you produce is fear, and then you produce anger. And anger is an amphetamine. It gives you energy, and it's an analgesiac. It numbs your pain. So it's an incredible chemical. And I could ask in the chat box, but I am sure that many of you have students that are addicted to anger. And there's a reason for it. It's a wonderful chemical. How many pages is the book? 151.
And then Beth writes, can you pull up the emotional needs slides and emotional dances and expand on it a little bit more?
Yeah. Uh-huh. The emotional dance is this, okay? Here's the way we talk about it. First of all, I ask the audience, who walked into your classroom? And the answer is a lot more people than you knew. Okay. Johnny brought in his angry dad, his drug addicted mother, his dead sister. Okay. And then you bring in your own people too. We all do. I ask audiences, who do you bring with you when you come to work? And a lot of people say, well, my husband, my children, my dog, my mother-in-law. We all bring stuff in. And so what we got, we think we have 25 kids in the room. We've actually got 75. And one of the reasons that there's a lot more noise before holidays and after holidays are people are bringing in a lot more people in their heads with them. Okay. And so a lot of times who they, when they react to you, they're not actually reacting to you. They're reacting to the people they brought in the room with. And then it's exacerbated by this next thing about energy. One of the things, you say that anger is a chemical, but what is the underlying chemical or neurotransmitter with anger? Keith, all I know is that it is, it produces an amphetamine and a chemical that functions as an amphetamine, and it, an energizac. I need to look that up. That's a good question. I don't know. And I don't know if it's cortisol. I do know that when people get stimulated, the reward circuitry of the brain operates off of, dopamine. So I'm not sure. I'll check that out. Okay. But what happens in energy levels is this. The research is in adults that you, I don't think I have time to explain about mitochondria. You get your mitochondria from your mother. Okay. And your, it's the bacterial organism that is in every cell of your body that works with two things, glucose and, oxygen, the food and oxygen. And it creates byproducts when it makes energy. Well, some people have bigger engines than other people do. And the research is that energy climbs for adults until they're in their mid to late 30s. Okay. But there's also a responsibility line. And what happens is that thing continues to climb until you're in your mid to late 60s. So what happens for a lot of adults is this. You engage in responsibilities in your 20s and early 30s, like children, like a mortgage, like a career, because you think your energy is going to keep growing. And then all of a sudden, what I'm seeing in schools is people hit their 40s, okay? They've been in teaching 20 years. They got another 20 years to go. And all of a sudden, the kids are harder than they've ever been, okay? Curriculum and instruction is harder than it's ever been. Teaching is more demanding than it's ever been. And they're thinking, I don't know if I can do this anymore, okay? And on top of that, okay, they've got a mortgage, they got a kid in college, and they're like, and that's when anxiety climbs, in that discrepancy, in worry, and it takes energy away then from the task at hand, and it is actually impacts the classroom emotionally. So, there's 6 minutes left. Any more questions?
In answer to someone's question about the Zoom presentation, I've put it in the chat box several times now, but if you're an NEESP member, this video recording will be available to download at www.naesp.org/webinars. Just put your membership number in into our website so you can log in, and then you'll be able to download it. Ruby, this has been an awesome presentation. I know a lot of people have gotten very excited about your book. Could you go back to the front so they could see what the book is again? Emotional Poverty, wasn't it?
Yes, it's Emotional Poverty. Let me go back to the very front. And you can go to our website, www.ahaprocess.com, and get it. We are not selling it on Amazon because Amazon takes 55%.
Oh, mkalish@ahaprocess.com. Well, again, thank you, everyone. Thank you, Dr. Payne, for sharing your thoughts. And with that, we will end today's webinar. Hope you all have a wonderful holiday season.